The Irish Times Inside Business Podcast, in association with EY, building a better working world.
Hello, this is Ciarán Hancock. Welcome to Inside Business. This week I was joined in studio by Barry Napier, the chief executive of Cubic Telecom. He was chosen as the Irish Times Business Person of the Year for 2023, having last year led the sale of a 51% stake in his business to Japanese investment giant SoftBank for a cool €473 million. This netted Napier and his fellow investors a huge windfall. In this interview, you'll hear Barry talk to me about his childhood, including a couple of years in Chicago, his challenges with the Leaving Cert, and his early career as an entrepreneur before joining Cubic more than 15 years ago. Cubic's technology is plugged into the future of smart cars, and Napier is excited about the growth opportunities on the road ahead. He also talks about his leadership style and what impact securing a big check has had in his lifestyle. Here we go. So, Barry Napier, thank you for joining me here in studio. And first of all, I suppose I should congratulate you on winning the Irish Times Business Person of the Year for last year. You mentioned on stage on the night it was your first award in since 1983, which was a road safety award.
Yeah, I did it. I was in CBC Monkstown, third class, and I did a drawing of Dennis the Menace, said, "Don't be a menace on the road." And I won a £25 voucher with a guy in my class called Evan O'Reilly. So going back then, that was the last award I would have really been recognised for. So it was great to be recognised again.
Yeah, good. Okay, that's interesting. Is it true you didn't do your Leaving Cert or you didn't pass your Leaving Cert?
I wouldn't have done well on my Leaving Cert. I have to say I completed it, but I did physics and I failed physics, and which is quite ironic because my physics teacher lives less than 500 metres from my house now. So every time I go by and I nod at him, I kind of go, yeah, I thought I was a bit smarter than I was and got an F in physics.
Well, look, you're doing okay because you sold the 51% stake in your business. I know you weren't alone in this business. I'm sure you're going to give shout outs to the various people who've helped you along the way. But €473 million SoftBank paid for a 51% stake in the business. And you got a very nice check out of that. So you've done okay.
I think a couple of things, you know, quantum is one thing to be recognised for. But I think the team and to actually have an Irish company to have done such an international deal and been recognised internationally and globally, I think that has been a massive driver for the team. And again, for Ireland Inc., it was a great lift from a lot of the entrepreneurs that I met, not alone on the night of the awards, but a lot over December and January, especially when you're sitting in Nearies or you're in town and you're bumping into a lot of people. It gave everyone a great pep to kind of say, look, Ireland can do it. So it was great.
Yeah, sure. Okay, tell us about Cubic Telecom, because at the moment you're a business in the smart vehicles world, and we'll chat about that in a couple of moments. But take us back to around 2007 when this business began trading. What were you doing then?
So I started off as an investor in Cubic back in the end of 2008, 2009. So the company was registered by Pat Phelan, an entrepreneur from Cork. He had a vision to try and eliminate roaming. And in about 2008, 2009, the company wasn't doing well and it got proposed that I should have a look at it. So Pat came up and met me. We had a discussion and we kind of had a view of where he wanted to go and what I'd like to do with the business. So I started off as an investor in the business. It was only four people in the company. And then the more we kind of got into it, it was, you can't really eliminate roaming unless you own a mobile network and the radio access, which obviously, they didn't have four people in an office down in Cork. They were a very good marketing tool, is what I would say to you at the time. So they kind of lured a lot of people in, including investors and ourselves. And the team, I would have said to you, were pretty good at the time. And Pat, as you see, has been a multiple entrepreneur and a great gift to the gab, is what I would say to you. And a hardworking guy as well. So I think when we kind of started putting some money in, we really realised that you need to have a mobile network and you need to actually be a friend of the mobile operators, not be an enemy. And I think back then it was Maxroam and they were really an enemy of the operator because they were trying to say how they could be cheaper and better than the operator using the own operator services. So we kind of stood back as a team and said, look, we wanted to build a platform that you could do connectivity. We become the Apple distributor, Nokia distributor and Samsung distributor in Ireland. So we understood how distribution worked and really thought if we could bring distribution to connectivity on a global scale, it would solve a lot of problems. So that's really where we went back and said, okay, we can either use our investment in Cubic or we can just set up another company to do that. So we spoke to some of the shareholders then and said, look, we'll invest and double down on the company and we'll just use this as a platform rather than setting up a new company. And that's what we did and we just built it on from there.
So you said you became an investor in the business at that stage. What were you doing before then? What gave you the money to invest?
So we had the Nokia, Apple and Samsung distribution in Ireland. We'd built that up from, I'd say, 1999, 2000. In 2008, we were in the top 250 companies in Ireland for revenue. We built that up to about 155 million euros a year. So we had done pretty well. We'd done global expansions of selling phones all around the world. So we really had a good understanding how to move around the world, how to operate in different markets. So that gave us some free cash flow that we had on our balance sheet. And that's what we use as the investment vehicle then into Cubic and then for further investment.
Okay, so you do your Leaving Cert. Doesn't go too great. What do you do then?
So when I left school, got a job straight away, ended up in a great company called Bolton & Company in Camden Street. It was a rubber stamp company. So, you know, great thrill. People say you come out and do rubber stamps, but they had a sign business there and we started doing graphic design, started doing more designs and then started doing signs for the likes of Paddy McKillen for all the, what you call it, Captain Americas and stuff like that. And really found out that there was real money in graphic design and sign design. I started building up that business. I bought a mobile phone. It didn't work. I returned the phone, got another phone. It didn't work. So then they ended up putting me onto the distributor, started chatting to the distributor and then he offered me a job. He said, would you like to come and work with us? So that's how I got into the phone business when about 19, 20 years of age. I've been in technology ever since. So almost 30 years, I'd like to say.
What did you say to him that prompted him to offer you a job?
You can't be selling this type of stuff and not standing over it. I'd be polite to your listeners. It wasn't exactly the Limerick language that I used when I was there. It was a little bit more direct. So a gentleman by the name of Mervyn Chamney, MCJ down in Nace, and started working with them. I think we did really well. Left there then and ended up then working with Tony Boyle and Des Crotty out in Sigma, and was there for about 4.5 years, 5 years out there with Motorola, and we bought that then to a multi-brand distribution company as well, and then just said, look, I'm going to go do my own thing. And after about 4 or 5 years, I just left, set up my own business with another partner and started building up CTC, which was Celtic Telecom Consultants, and then ultimately bought Brightpoint back in 2002, 2003. So worked very closely with Arthur Cox, and that was, I would say to you, kind of a real thrilling experience for coming from someone that, you know, hadn't the academic background, that you're sitting in Arthur Cox and you're buying a component of a NASDAQ quoted company and getting the tax expertise and the tax education and then the legal education of how companies are formatted and stuff like that. So I think that was absolutely excellent. And again, had some really good people with me on that journey. One of them still with me, Barry Higginbottom. So I think that was kind of, I would say to you, really cool. It was kind of like a scene from Suits or something where you're sitting in these big offices in Arthur Cox, you know. And I think a very funny story is that we were sitting in there and they said, look, you're going to be here for the whole day. So we ended up getting, I think it was a 20 pence piece and sliding across the table and playing games across back and forth. And we got caught kneeling on the boardroom trying to go for a score, Barry Higginbottom did. So when they walked in, there he is kneeling on the boardroom trying to shoot the goals with his 20 pence piece that we used to do as kids in school. So we've always had good crack, I would say to you. So working in Cubic or working in BPI, I think anyone will say to you, it's always been a bit of crack, always been a bit of fun.
So there's an entrepreneurial bent there, clearly. What's the family background, mum and dad? What do they do?
Dad was an engineer and like a draftsman as such, and mum was just a housewife. So mum passed away tragically in 1986. She was about 42. And then dad said, come on, let's go. So we went off, said, let's pack our bags, went to Chicago. After 2 years, dad said, hey, this isn't exactly great, is it? Let's go back home. So it was literally bounced in, bounced out. So I got to see the yellow bus going to school every day, riding in Chicago. I got to see extreme heat, extreme cold. And then when we came back to Ireland, I said, let's go back to Limerick. And dad said, no, we're going back to Dublin. I prefer Dublin. So I went back to Limerick and stayed with my grandmother for about a year. Went to JFK school out in the Ennis Road. And dad said, come on, you need to come back to the family. So good family background is what I'd say to you. Hardworking. And I always had a good laugh with the family and very comfortable either in Limerick or in Dublin.
And siblings?
Siblings, three sisters, which is funny because I have a sister from the first marriage, my oldest sister, Gwen, and then I have two baby sisters from the second marriage. And everyone says, oh, they're your half-sisters. And if you ever see them, there's no halves in the Napiers. So always good fun with them.
Yeah, okay. Interesting in going to Chicago for 2 years. Your dad must have had a visa or something.
Yeah, so I think my wife, who I'm married to now, her folks went to Canada. So I think in, you know, the middle of the 80s, everyone had this, you know, let's get up and go. The world's a better place somewhere else. They ended up staying in Canada. Dad picked Chicago. I think that was a tough spot because of the climate. I think if we went to the West Coast, I don't think we would have come back. So you had the choice back then of New York or Chicago. So he got a green card. He got a job. We went up, set up and literally moved everything. And we were there for 2 years. And he just says, I just don't feel at home here. you know, you're a kid, you can't exactly say I'm staying.
What age were you now at this age?
14.
Okay.
So, and then my sister Gwen was 16. So the funny thing is that my sister Gwen ended up going back. So when she finished school back here, she was jumped on a plane, went straight back and lived in Chicago and lived back in the States for a couple of years with all our friends that she was in school with there. And then ultimately came back to Ireland then again.
Okay. And have you been back to Chicago since? Catch up with any old school friends? Or
Chicago is a connecting point for me right now because of Detroit. So obviously we do a lot of business in Detroit, being in the car element of things. So there's no direct flight. So you always connect through Chicago. And if anyone goes through Chicago, it's either going to be absolutely snowing and you're caught there for a day or two, or you've got winds or something else. So I'd fly through. I've touched base a couple of times with people that I was in 7th and 8th grade, but I didn't have a lot of connection back there. Like, I'm 30 years out of there now.
Okay. Let's come back to Cubic Telecom. So you're invested in the smart vehicle space. Tell us how and how you see that evolving over the next number of years.
If you look back, it was all in the plan. I think Cubic was a company that did everything wrong and learned from its mistakes. And the one thing that myself and the team do is try to share those experiences as quick as we can with anybody else to make sure they make those mistakes either a lot quicker or recognize them a lot quicker. So we would have started off trying to put connectivity into laptops and tablets. So we had worked very closely with Lenovo, HP and Panasonic, a great relationship with them. Got on the radar at Qualcomm. They had a Gobi chipset, which is now the Snapdragon chipset, and they were trying to make connectivity into all devices. Big challenge that you have, especially like here in the Irish Times, if someone sends you in a laptop, it goes straight into your IT team and they put your own their own software and their own security system on it, which wipes everything. So anytime you went on a point of manufacture, you were wiped as soon as it came into Irish Times. You had to start all over again. So we found that the connectivity ratio was very low. So you probably have about 40% of people that would use the device with connectivity built in. So it was a very hard market to try and get people to adapt to. So costly to enter into it because you had to provide the connectivity. You had to provide the plastic SIM cards at the time, which were probably costing about anywhere from 5 to 8 euros. So your cost of acquisition of the customer back then for a small startup was pretty heavy. So we're trying to figure out what other markets we could get into. So when we started launching that back in about 2012, 2013, if you remember the Web Summit, it used to be in the RDS. And I think it was in 2013, Elon Musk was here. And he was driving beside me in a blue Tesla with an English registration on it. I was like talking to somebody in Nokia on the phone, a gentleman called Owen Cruz. And I was like, Cruiser, you're not going to believe this, but Musk is sitting beside me. Those cars must be connected, are they? And we just did a bit of research. I think that would have been September, October timeframe. The Web Summit used to be on back then. By January, we'd been introduced to Tesla. I think it was January 21st or 22nd of January. And by April, that year, we were standing on stage with Elon Musk and President Liu in China, launching Tesla in China, and we'd got the Chinese market and the Hong Kong market. So we were very, the team were very adaptable, how to create a solution very, very quickly, and we worked excessively hard. And the funniest markets was China and Hong Kong is the ones that we landed back then. So that would have got us into the market.
So what were you doing for Tesla?
Providing the connectivity, so when the car shipped out of the US, it then needed a different SIM card. We provided the SIM card. We'd done a deal with China Unicom at the time. We put China Unicom SIMs and profiles into our systems, which then means when the car landed in China, it could connect to a Chinese network. So it got met all the regulation standards and all the connectivity standards. So we started doing that. That, I think, got us on the radar that we it was in the press, and then Volkswagen Group, Audi at the time were having challenges, so then they reached out to us. So we met with Audi at the time. They had about 800,000 cars that were behind on their connectivity program, and we solved that solution for them in less than 50, 55 days with their executive team. And then they just said, okay, fine, look, we're going to invest into you. So they took a 15 million investment in us 70 days later, and kind of then onward and upward. So it was kind of the dominoes started falling for us then. So we were at that stage, we hadn't reached the tipping point. Everyone always talks about this tipping point of where you get to. Jerry McQuaid, who I would say to is kind of like the godfather in the company. You know, he's the wise owl in there that we'd always go to for a bit of advice. Says, we haven't hit tipping point yet. So once we started getting into Audi vehicles, we'd launched them in 13 markets, and we did that in less than 4 months. So a real big introduction for us, and we started getting scale then. So come 2016, we had probably 120,000 cars. that we connected that year. So that started getting us a lot of momentum. A lot of the mobile operators then started seeing, okay, this is a company that their software is working, their connectivity is working. So we started partnering and not going head to head with the operator. So I think the challenging part that we had as a scaling business is that, you know, are you a frenemy? So are you a friend or what are you? And I got a lot of the large mobile operators wants to own the customer. And our view was, we don't want to own the customer. We want to give the best customer experience. We'll partner. And we got probably about 40, 50 partnerships by 2018 that we'd working with mobile operators. So we started getting some real credibility in the marketplace. We now have just touching 100 mobile operator partners. And for us, they're all tier one operators. So they're the best in each one of those markets. So it's a real credible solution that we bought in. And they're not a software company. So people always think connectivity is free because when you connect Wi-Fi at home, you don't pay for it because you're just on a flat fee. It's completely different in a mobile world. And then the operator's networks, all those components are completely different. They're not standardized. So all devices operate differently. So we really got into the whole technology of how can we unify that and solve all those complex problems. So I'd like to say that, you know, my Leaving Cert really paid off. And going to college really paid off for me because now I'm running a real technical company with some amazing minds. And you get to sit down and solve real complex issues. And, you know, you're talking about Brazil one day, the next time you're talking about Manila and somewhere. So it's very exciting to see how the different technologies works and how you deal with those complex situations. And it's actually really cool because you get to sit down with people who are really smarter than you and not feel inferior because you're having those conversations of how to solve problems. And it's kind of, you know, throwing the Rubik's Cube across the table back and forth. It's good fun.
So did you learn something from your days, the early days, in terms of roaming when you discovered that, you know, you need to own a network really to be able to control roaming? Were there lessons learned then that you applied, as you say, with your mobile relationships a decade ago?
Yeah, so if you look at it, roaming was a great solution in the early days, but very expensive, very costly. And now is like people are consuming huge amounts of data. Like if you remember before, you used to get this text message, you have 20 megabytes, you know, you're about to cut off, or you get huge bills. Like you're using that on a daily basis now, if not a weekly basis. So consumption and our need for data is exploding. And they call data like the new oil or the new gas. You know, data's not going to stop. And with AI coming out, it's even going to explode even more. So the consumption of data, no one can really fathom it. And try to put a price on that is a real challenge. The complexity of transiting data, the slower the data is, the worse the experience is going to be. That's roaming for you because roaming goes through so many different partners. And you can never get a service level agreement with roaming. Because if you think about it, if I'm an Irish guy and I'm going off to the States, I'm roaming on a US, like who's my service level agreement? Well, it's going to be with Vodafone here in Ireland, or it's going to be with Three here in Ireland. So I'm going to ring Three to sort out my problem that I'm having in New York. It just doesn't work. And it's pretty complex. If you look at the likes of devices that we're bringing onto the networks, they're high value assets. They're vehicles, they're agricultural machinery. Like they're anywhere from tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands. People want really good experiences when they have that. And to have a lag or a really bad experience, like it's pretty frustrating. Like, you know, you're at home and you lose your Wi-Fi, you can't live. Imagine having a vehicle that you've spent 150,000 on, or a combine harvester, and you can't connect. It has a massive impact for you. So the demand of, you know, just real clean, simple connectivity is huge, and people underestimate the complexity of that. And I think that's where the team at Cubic have really carved out a uniqueness in the market for us.
So what's Elon Musk like?
Taller than me. I'm 6 foot, and I thought I was tall until I met him. He's about 6'4", very serious guy. I have to say, very little interaction with him. Met him once, I think twice I've met him at the time. And I would just say, you just know when you're with him, like the brain is always going. Is what I say to the brain is always like massive thinker, thinks extremely big, solves complex situations very, very quickly. But his team, again, his team are phenomenal. Now he goes through a lot, is what I say to you, but he's the best brains in the world. So the ideas that they're coming up with are phenomenal.
Are you still working with Tesla?
Nope. We have not worked with Tesla since about 2018 because a regulation changed in China. So that limited our experience with Tesla.
And how did you get your foot in the door with them initially?
We heard they were having challenges entering into China and Hong Kong. We'd worked obviously with Qualcomm. Qualcomm had a relationship with Tesla. We literally tried everything. We're the kind of company, and I'm the type of person, if we want something, if you wake up on Saturday morning, I'll be cutting your lawn or washing your car, waving in the window going, "Hey, Karen, anything you need?" And you'd be like, what's he doing here? So I'd say we're very resourceful as a sales network of getting in and building relationships. And then I think we've created a great credibility of execution in a complex market. So I think any of the customers that we have will tell you that, you know, it's not a simple solution. You know, the team, very thorough. We're actually now seen as real experts at what we've done. So we've carved that out of from 2011 to 2014 of being that startup, that gritty company. 2016, we started getting real credibility. Now we're, you know, becoming the market leader, if not the market expert. So people are now knocking on the door. So it's kind of a little bit of a different cycle than we've been going through.
So what's your key skill? What's your unique talent? Is it sales? Is it creativity? Persistence? What is it?
I would say to you, all of those above, but I think the one thing that I've learned definitely on the journey of Cubic is, you know, hire people that are smarter than you and give them the space and the runway to take off. So I think the one thing that I've learned definitely in the last couple of years is that if you hire someone that's really, really smart, my role as the CEO, I call myself the coffee and entertainment officer. So I'm here to make sure that that expert, that his job or her job is really, really clear. It's defined for them. And any obstacles that are in the way, it's my role there to clear that off them so they can be successful and bring that unity into the team, which I think is a little bit more different than a lot of CEOs. So the ego for me is like, I'll hold the door open, I'll make the cup of tea, I'll bring the pizza in. I'm not the engineer. So make sure the engineer is fueled, he's ready, he's got electricity, he's got Wi-Fi, they have, and up they go and get things going. So I think perseverance, I'm relentless is what I will say to you. The team have now got that relentless into them, so I can ease off being relentless. Perseverance, while it's a great word, innovation really comes in a lot more than perseverance. I think, you know, when you're looking at the solutions that we're trying to bring, when someone says to us no, you know, we don't go, let's persevere. We're going like, why is it a no? And, you know, try to figure out what the no is. And you can always solve a lot of things with software. Okay, and if you look at it, go back to years ago where we all had a comms room and we had always had a lot of hard drives in there. They're gone now. It's all in the cloud, but no one knows where the cloud exists, you know, but we all talk about the cloud. I think the one thing in Cubic is we're very curious as a team and, you know, we're curious, but yet we're cautious. So we'll sit down, security is at the high level, integrity is at the high level, but how can we solve the problem? And, you know, they put in long hours. You know, we're not a company that comes in. If you come into our office on a Friday and everyone will say to you, I've never been in an office with so many people in Dublin on a Friday. They're not there because they're mandated to be there. They're there because they want to be there. And they're solving complex problems all around the world, which is, I think, to you, which is pretty fun. So perseverance, innovation is key for us. You know, no is not an option. Of course, you can solve it, but let's sit down and try to figure it out. And those curious minds are in there and willing to do that.
And how would you describe your leadership style?
Immense. It's fun and I think they really enjoy working with me. They're all still there is what I would say to you. So that could be perseverance. I would say to you, I've adapted an awful lot. I would have said to you, it would have been very difficult 10 years ago. I said it would have been awkward 5 years ago. Now I'm a lot more comfortable with myself. I'm a lot more comfortable that I've got the real experts around the table that's needed to bring the journey on. And I need to make sure that I'm not in their way. And I think so getting back and letting that expert be the expert and giving them the fuel and the energy that they need, the motivation they need, that's really my purpose right now. So it's not to be the smartest person in the room. And, you know, when you're listening, you should be listening to solve the problem rather than listening to give the answer. So I think that's a big learning that I've had over the last couple of years.
How can harnessing the power of AI help drive your business? At EY, we combine leading business expertise with cutting-edge technology and capabilities. Working directly with you to plan your strategy, we will accelerate your AI-enabled transformation. To learn more, visit ey.ai/IE.
Let's sort of break down in simple terms exactly how this works. So I have a smart car or smartish car. Let's say I sit inside. What role is Cubic playing in that car?
So when you turn on your interface or your screen in your car, that is not us. We're behind that. So you'll have that operating system. So that could be absolutely anything from the car OEM's original operating system. It could be CarPlay. It could be Google. It could be absolutely anything else. Okay, but then that needs to connect, and that's where Cubic comes in. So we're behind that. So we're the pipe that goes from that vehicle then to the cell tower and from the cell tower back to that OEM's IT department. So if you think about it, a prime example here is if you turn on your Golf or your Passat today here in Dublin, That will then turn on, your map will come on, and then behind that is Cubic. Okay, Cubic then will connect that car to a network here in Ireland. It could be probably likely it's going to be Vodafone, is what I would say to you. Then that will connect onto the Vodafone network through Cubic's core. Mm. Then it will go from Cubic's core back into the IT infrastructure of the Volkswagen Group to make sure that the software is up to date, all the licenses are up to date for the operating system of the vehicle. And then we monitor that vehicle over the lifetime. So that could be anywhere from 10 to 15 years.
Right, okay. And who are your rivals?
I'd love to say to you, we have none. So it would have started off being the mobile operator, is what I would say to you. So definitely in the beginning, the operator thought they were smarter than us. And it was a real fight to figure out, you know, with the role that we played. When you're a startup, you know, you think you can solve everything. And I think we very much got into that software-defined vehicle, that software role. So we're very complementary then to the mobile operator, because, you know, they spend billions to the government for their licenses. So you have to be respectful to that. And they spend billions on the rollout. So there has to be a fee there for connectivity. So we started helping them on that sales process. And then we started using software to make accessing to their network and to their solutions and enhancing their solutions a lot better. So I think that partnership model started really working very well for us. Then we came across then, I would say, to the hardware players, the likes of Ericsson and Nokia. So they were trying to get into this space. They've now reverted out of this space in the last probably about 36 months. So it's really left us kind of there. So I think the one thing is, you know, we're not egotistical to think that we're the only ones in the market, but we've created a real boutique in the automotive space and agricultural space. We're very focused on that, but we do it across partnerships. So we're not a dominant player, is what I'd say, and we don't want to be a dominant player. What we want to be is a real unique player and using software to solve that. So the partnership with the OEM or the manufacturer, and then the partnership with the operator. So we have a real nice defined space right in the middle for us.
How many car brands have you got on your list?
So the funny thing is, there's probably only about, let's say, 30 car brands globally. Out of that, we've probably were working or talking with probably about a third of them. With our partnership now with SoftBank, has tried to expand that and get that up into 50% of conversations and get on the radar, and then really start, you know, proving our power and using, you know, the use case that we use and cross-pollinate across. So it's a 3 to 5 year sale into an auto OEM. Like, they don't move quickly, even though that would be pretty quickly, because they were like a 5 to 7 year sale. So I think Tesla really defined that, how they can do things a lot quicker. So I think car manufacturers have had to change from being a metal press company to moving towards a more software model and creating a lot of more velocity in how they move and how they change. So I'd say to you right now, we probably a pipeline of where we're talking to about 50% of all car manufacturers. You know, again, we're only 350 people. So there's only so much that you can do. So, and those sales cycles are long. So, you know, if we can get up, we're in about 10 to 12% of connected vehicles right now. Our goal is to try and get to 25%. So working with SoftBank to really start focusing on that.
What kind of revenues last year?
Last year, we were hitting probably just over $70 million. And this year, we'll break over $100
million. Over $100 million, right. Okay.
You always use dollars. And I know we're in the Eurozone. It just sounds bigger when you say a dollar, doesn't it? There's the salesman in me trying to make it sound
bigger. It's almost parity with the euro. So it's, Anyway, one thing that strikes me about a lot of, maybe I'm just not driving the right cars, but a lot of the displays that you get in cars are very convoluted, they're clunky, they're hard to use, especially when you're on the move. Is that going to change, or, you know, is there anything you guys can do to make that process better, or are they doing something, is there something wrong, something missing in that whole thing, and that it's not better? As I say, maybe I'm just driving the wrong cars, but that's been my experience of it.
So one, is there anything, we can only do the back part, the connectivity, make it simpler and easier. I think the challenge that you have right now is the car manufacturers had an operating system. Every single one was different. And then you had the likes of Google and Apple come out. So you're a device that you use every day. Then you wanted to use that in the vehicle. The challenge that you have then is then that those brands are taking over the experience in the vehicle. And when you bought a vehicle before, you were buying it because of the experience. You were buying the logo. You were buying because of the texture of the car, the look of the car, and the performance of the car. That's kind of changing right now with the next generations coming up. They, you know, they're not too worried about the brake horsepower of the car. You know, they're not about the power or anything else that's in the vehicle. They're very much like, is it connected? How does it use, you know, the sustainability? So the mindset has really changed to the driver profile. I think the challenge that you have is that ecosystem is owned by real dominant players right now. And I think that the car manufacturers are seeing that they really are at the beck and call of those type of dominant players. So you've seen the likes of GM now have done a U-turn to say that actually, you know, they're going to have their own operating system, and you're going to see other car companies kind of pulling back from that, because otherwise they lose their personality, they lose why you bought the brand and why you're invested into that brand. So I think that convoluted user experience, it's like when you get in, they'll ask you if you want to go to CarPlay, they'll ask you if you want to go to Google Gas, they'll ask you if you want different types of solutions. You know, when at the end of the day, you're buying a brand, you should want to wear that brand. That's my view on it. But there again, you know, I was always an Android guy, I was a Nokia guy originally, and I've conceded to Apple. So, like, you know, it gets into you, doesn't it? And you want a simpler way of life. So, but there again, you just saw, I don't know if you saw about 6 weeks ago, Apple said they're pulling out of the car business after 10 years of trying to define their role in it.
Yeah, so it's an expensive business, obviously, to be in, and a tricky one as well. But you've talked about smart vehicles being mobile phones on wheels, and that the connectivity and the part it'll play in our lives will only grow. So take us on that journey, let's say, over the next 5 to 10 years, how you see it evolving, and also this journey towards autonomous vehicles.
So autonomous vehicles have been here for a while. The problem you have there is regulation. So the software is there, the technology is there. The challenge that you have is that the regulations in Dublin is completely different than the ones in Paris, completely different than the ones then in Munich. And so the challenge that you have is that it's not unified, the approach that's been taken by different governments around the world. So that's where the challenge is. So it's not the software, the technology. So let's roll on and take that off the table for a moment and look at, well, you know, what can a car do? Well, a car can then tell you what time you're going to get home, turn on your lights, have the heating ready. There's a lot more interactions you can do. So if I don't know if you've had any of those Alexa plugs put into your house or the Google plugs put into your house, where from anywhere you can turn the lights on, turn your heating on. Like, if you remember, did you turn the immersion off? Do you remember when we were growing up? You got a clatter if you left the immersion on. Now it's you pull out your phone and you can turn it off. So I think all of that will get integrated, but that's a generational problem. It's not a technology problem, okay? And when you say to someone here, you know, I can give you this plug, you can turn your heat on, you can turn your heat off, you can turn your lights on, you know, there's people who are later on in life who just don't understand that, where there's others who just really accept it. Like, if you put a phone now with a dial keypad in front of, you know, a 5 or 10 year old, I don't think they'll understand what it is, because they just pick it up or they swipe. So I think it's a generational thing. So I think, you know, that you leave your house, you can time things, you start seeing that your calendar and your emails will really start becoming part of that. They're talking about now when autonomous vehicles come in that the car will come, you'll have a smaller car from a Monday to a Friday come collect you, you'll be doing some work if you're working, and then you may have a different type of utility vehicle that you rent. So it might be more on-demand vehicles than rather than spending on a vehicle. If you see what's happened recently, that a lot of people bought a lot of EVs, they were highly expensive to buy. And then if you look at the EV market, it's crashed, and it's really crashed hard. It definitely in the last 12 months, I think the semiconductor challenge that you saw over COVID, where getting computer components, you know, prices really held, especially in electrical vehicles. But you buy one now and it's worth 50% 18 months later. That's a challenge. So I think, you know, where we have function on demand, you're going to have cars on demand and get it. But again, generational and governmental challenge that you have there. I think autonomous vehicles will come in. As I said, that technology has been here for a long time. But like, I got into a Tesla, landed in Schiphol Airport. I'd say the lady that collected us must have been in her late 60s, early 70s. She was driving a Tesla, and then she took her hands off the wheel and just started chatting away to us for 10 minutes and the car drove us there in Amsterdam. And it was phenomenal to be in, because you're kind of like, do you want to put your hands back on the wheel? So I was able to see how someone, when they wanted to, in a different generation, was able to adapt to something. So I think it's just the adaption and getting more familiar with it.
Yeah.
I think will happen. It's kind of like the bicycle lanes in Dublin. Like, there was no bicycles 20 years ago, if you remember, and everyone used to say the weather's horrible. Now there's bicycle lanes everywhere and everyone's on bikes. Weather's still the same.
Sure everyone's on bicycles now, fairness. But anyway, the weather's probably worse. But just in terms of the autonomous piece, because they've had autonomous taxis, they've been trying them in San Francisco, they were licensed and so on. It didn't go well.
Again, you see, you got to remember, so technology is one component, but human nature is a different one. They'll still walk in front of a car and do something different. And then you've got to, you know, the laws of, you know, you've got to build up the data to make sure that everything's right and everything. Did you really think that someone was going to jump on top of the car or something was going to go or happen? Or did you actually think someone was going to fall asleep in the car and let the car drive to work? There's certain things that you think of
some of those you may not think of, and then you have a tragedy or you have an accident or something else, and then there's a learning behind that or there's a block put in that. So I think go back to when people started to fly aeroplanes and you said, oh, they're going to take off and land themselves. We never thought that, but that's happening with 80% coming in and out of Dublin Airport right now. And then if you look at Man of Drones, Bobby Healy, amazing entrepreneur, right now he's got drones delivering your McDonald's and your coffee, you know. So I think it's timing. The technology's been there. You know, it's having someone that will try to push the bar an awful lot. That's what you see with Tesla. They try to push it an awful lot. So I think the challenge is the governmental regulation being standardized. The challenge that you have is when it comes to government and policy, no government will follow the other government in great alignment. And that's where the challenge I see it in the short term being.
Okay, so looking to your crystal ball, when do you see autonomous driving being ubiquitous?
We say this every year when we meet. The standard answer is 5 years, but it's been 5 years now for 20 years in any of the events that I've ever been at. So, you know, I'd say to you, it's 5 years.
Right. Okay. We'll get you back in 5 years and check that out. So SoftBank have bought into the business late last year. That's all signed, sealed and delivered, done, dusted. Now they own 51%. You still have that other 49% stake that you and your fellow investors continue to own. And you've said that the opportunities are fantastic and the opportunities for the other 49% are probably greater than they were for the 51%, if that makes any sense. So tell us about those opportunities, how you see it unfolding over the next 3 to 5 years.
So a couple of things. So while SoftBank acquired 51%, they're now a shareholder. So while we talk about the 49%, we also talk about the 100%. So the whole idea is to drive value for the 100%. So because SoftBank invested in the company, you know, the whole idea then is to grow quicker, faster, use their expertise, use their network, use their relationships as well. So that really adds in to that 49, 51, 100% and really create that value and drive that value on for the business. For myself and then the 49% that are there, and we still hold 12.5% of the business. You know, there's huge opportunity there to drive that on. So there's that perseverance, determination, innovation streak is just as much there, if not more. I think having the likes of SoftBank coming to the table and, you know, making such a big statement in the market to say, you know, they want to be bigger out of Japan, they want to bring all their technology and all their investments and try to bring it into one area. And they chose Cubic to do it, I think, is pretty phenomenal, because they would have done a lot of research. It wasn't like they were walking down the road, bumped into us in Neary's, had a pint and said, let's do the deal. Like, it was pretty tedious, you know, there was a lot of due diligence. They looked at a lot of players in the market and ultimately they picked the team, which was excellent. And it is a team. So I think that has been absolutely excellent. I think now if I look at them and what they can bring to the table, you know, Masasan, you know, he's a big gambler, you know, he big bets, you know, some have paid off, some haven't paid off. And the ones that didn't pay off, he tries to reshape. But if you look at Arm recently, you know, Arm, like he launched that at $50, everyone thought, you know, that's going to be a bit crazy. And he's up at $130, $140 a share now. And then you've got NVIDIA at the same time that it's gone up doubled and tripled as well. So I think him and the team are absolutely excellent at picking and backing winners, is what I'd say, as long as the teams are aligned on what the goals are. We're very aligned with them on what our goals are. I would say it's been a very natural fit so far in all the communication, the conversations. It's very fluid. And it's kind of inspiring because now you have East meets West, where we have a real good presence and a strong brand over there that's really reputable, that really kind of pulls the two together. And I think the automotives, because they're global, are really seeing that that's coming together as a real platform for them to make sure that the East and West, they have a platform that they can use. So I think that is an excellent opportunity. And our current investors, who are Volkswagen Group, Cariad, their software division, and Qualcomm, are really excited about the opportunity. So if you look at that, we've actually got not only a real powerful shareholder base now, but we've got a shareholder base that punches a lot of power in a market, being a Qualcomm chips, Cariad as software arm of Volkswagen, and then SoftBank as well. SoftBank have over 400 investments in technology companies, and pulling that together, whether that's payments, technology, cybersecurity, like it's all at our fingertips now to really build out a really strong ecosystem.
So is there a plan, let's say, to buy SoftBank, to buy out that 49%, let's say, over the next 3 years? Are there targets set that you have to meet?
No, you know, we were very clear when we came together of, you know, do we go for an IPO? Do we do something bigger? So what I would say to you, like, there was no targets. There's no earn out, earn in. I think that's like, it's actually been, I would say to you, a really, really mature conversation that turned into a really mature deal that has really got everyone enthused around the table and the current shareholders that were there, as well as the new shareholder coming in. So there's a real common goal of, you know, let's really go and do something. And it's not, you know, you're not locked into something. You know, if I don't perform, I don't think I'll be there. If they don't like me, I don't think I'll be there. So, like, I have to work and I have to prove that I can do the job. The team have to do exactly the same. So I think having the access to them is something that's, you know, really good. Being an entrepreneur in Ireland, you know, the one thing that the entrepreneur community is really good is that you can pick up the phone here and you can ring multiple entrepreneurs that will give you either a contact or an introduction. That's how it works. Now we've got SoftBank, one of the biggest global software companies and IT companies in the world, with an amazing entrepreneur at the top of that knows every other entrepreneur on the planet and who all wants to be associated with him. So having that access, you know, is kind of inspiring, not just for me, for the team. So I think the opportunity is there. I think, again, the likes of Qualcomm, you know, they had the opportunity to say, let's take some money off the table and run away. And they were like, well, no, this is where we want to be. So they stayed in, carried it. So I think there's a whole direction of let's try and do something really, really big in the automotive and IoT space.
Right. Okay. Now, how has, you got a big check out of this, let's be honest about it, as did some others who were invested in the business. How has that changed you? Because you said that, you know, they could get rid of you if you want, you know, whatever. But you've got a lot of money behind you now. So how has that changed you? And how do you stay motivated to be chief executive of the business to continue to drive it on?
Well, I thought you'd notice the liposuction, the getting my lips done and the Turkish teeth. Since I came into the building, it's actually kind of surreal in one sense. So the transaction happened at the end of last year, and then we had regulation in between. So nothing happened in there. So everyone was complimenting you walking down the street in December or at any of the gigs that we were at. And I said to someone, it's kind of like, you know, being pregnant with your wife. You know, she knows, she can feel everything that's going on. You're sitting here going, I don't know what they're talking about. And then something hands you something. So when the baby was handed to me, it was a bit surreal because I wasn't in the country. And then you woke up the next day and it was actually no different than the day before, is what I'd say to you. So I think the money is an awkward thing at the beginning. Okay. So for me, I don't look at it. I don't go near it. It's kind of like a byproduct of it. I think the first thing I bought was this week. I went out and bought a Dyson. Okay, so just to let you know.
How much did you pay?
I went into Harvey Norman's for €849. So just, you know, and my wife laughed at me and said, hey, kids, he's actually finally bought something. Right, so just, you know, and why you laugh at that, Kieran, it's quite funny because I've sat down with the other lads and, like, none of them have bought anything. So at least I'm unique. At least I can say I bought a Hoover.
Yeah.
I think the most inspiring thing, and I said it on the night, was, you know, I got a text off one of the ladies in work to turn and say she paid off her mortgage. So that to me, and I even get emotional now, that's amazing. So you have 190 people that had about 75 million of access to them. When you sit there as a CEO, you go, wow, that's powerful.
190 people who had
access to 75 million.
75 million.
Yeah, is what they got out, split out amongst them. So people who've been with us on a long journey, like, it was, I think that's pretty powerful. We have another lady that was in the business that started with us on the customer care. And she went and did her Cisco exam. She became an engineer. And she's now just bought her first house out in Lucan. And you get that. That's inspiring. So for me, it's not what I have, it's what you've created and the team you've done it with.
So will you be like Tommy Kelly, let's say eShop World, who set up a family office, or Eamon Waters of Panda Waste, Boat Park, he set up a family office and they've been investing in various things and public companies and property and so forth. Will you, is that a road you're going to travel?
Well, let me open the door then for the further questions that you're going to pop at me. I think you stick to your knitting. I think my track record is when I went off the knitting, it didn't work in my advantage. A family office for me has a positive and a negative. You know, I don't think you need to have a family office. You know, Napier's won't have a family office, is what I'll say to you. You know, we're normal folks. We hang out with normal people and we have our friends are the most important things to us. So having a family office, what's that really going to get you? For me, as I said to you, we have 12, and I don't know why this keeps beeping my watch, and it's not that connected.
if you look at it, that I've 12.5% left in a company, I want to drive value for 100% of my shareholders. I have a track record of a team of working really, really well with them and driving value, not just in a complex solution, but also then in the revenue and the profit back for the business. That's what my focus is. If you set up a family office, you get distracted and then you start gambling and you start betting on property markets. Didn't do well out of property. Track record shows that. So for me, I'm just going to stick to the knitting. I really enjoy what I do. Like, I enjoy the team that I work with. I enjoy the problems that we're trying to solve. I love the innovation. I said to the Rubik's Cube, I love sitting there with talented people trying to solve a solution. You know, if you're doing that and the stock market's dropping or the property market's dropping, it's a distraction from the core of what you're doing. And I've made my money out of the core and I've made a business out of the core. So I don't need to go anywhere else. That's my view at this moment in time. Now, that may change, is what I will say to you. But my goal is not to drive on the check or the value. It's what I have in that business and what I've put 15 years of hard sweat and tears into, and a lot of tears went into that business. And it's not over yet. The fun is only about to start. And having like a great partnership with the likes of SoftBank and the other companies, like, that's where the fun is.
Well, I was going to ask you, you're 50 in July, if my maths is
Thanks
right.
Thanks for letting that out. Yeah.
So it's a personal milestone, let's face it. So how much longer do you see yourself doing this job before you, in inverted commas, retire?
So I can't curse because it wouldn't be good for your listeners. So I would say to you, for as long as the team allow me to enter the building, is what I would say to you, and the shareholders don't lock me out of the car park. So for me, I'm very honoured about the team that I get to lead. I think they're cool, they're fun. They're very diverse, is what I will say to you. And there's some big egos in there. And it's great fun to sit there and to play and have that cautious curiosity that's in there. I think that's really cool. And I really enjoy it. So that really motivates me to get up in the morning. It's not the paycheck. It's, you know, they'll always say, if someone says no to you, my first question is why? What's the no and how can we fix that and can we? And that's what really intrigues me. So having that every day, whether you're 50, 55 or 60, doesn't come into it. There is a time where you have to go to the team below you. Who wants the crack of it? Who wants the keys? I hope whoever takes the keys off me will put me in an innovation role and not outside washing the cars or cutting the lawn. So I got to keep my shareholders happy. Like, you know, you got to be really respectful. They've put an awful lot of money on the table. They put an awful lot of respect and confidence into the team. We've got to deliver on that. So it's not that, you know, you see me in Barbados, quite the opposite. It might be Torremolinos.
Barry Napier, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, that's it for this week from Inside Business. My thanks to Barry Napier for joining me on the show. John Casey produced this episode with JJ Vernon on sound. Thanks also to our sponsor EY for its continued support. Remember, as a subscriber to the Irish Times, you can get the latest business news straight into your inbox by signing up to our Business Today email at irishtimes.com. And you can also follow the Irish Times business feed on X, LinkedIn and Facebook each day. I'm Ciarán Hancock. Until next time, take care.
The Irish Times Inside Business Podcast, in association with EY, building a better working world.